Thanks to everybody for coming 9:30 a.m. on Saturday. We really appreciate it.
Troopers.
You guys are troopers. We'll try to make it worth your while. So my name is Fiona Morgan, and I'm a researcher at the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. And before that was a reporter for about 10 years, most recently at an alt-weekly in North Carolina called The Independent. And I've been working on a research project about the information needs of low-income people, which is sort of where the inspiration for this panel came from. A lot of my work is based around the Knight Commission report on information needs in communities. And the first part of their definition, the Knight Commission's definition of a healthy information community, is that people have convenient access to both civic and life-enhancing information without regard to income or social status. And in the process, I came across a couple of really smart blog posts when I was doing my research by this woman named Mary Lou Fulton, who I have to thank because she introduced me to two of the panelists here, Norberto and Tom. Mary Lou is a reporter for about 20 years at the Los Angeles Times and at the Washington Post, and she's now a program officer at a foundation called the California Endowment that, among other things, funds local news coverage of community health issues. And in the post, she talked about what she had observed 20 years as a reporter about what drives coverage of poor communities. She called it the murder and festival syndrome, which is that reporters typically don't show up in a low-income community unless there's some horrible crime or there's some kind of easy-to-cover event like an ethnic festival where you can take pictures of people dancing in their costumes and that sort of thing. But the ongoing information needs of that community, basically the need for local news, goes unmet. And this has been a problem for a long time. It long predates the internet, but it's particularly a big problem now as beats have changed. Beats at newspapers have gone from geography to topic. Newsrooms have cut back on staff, pulled out of certain suburbs and small towns, neighborhoods. And newspapers, in part for self-preservation, are focusing more and more on advertisers, subscribers, viewers, on eyeballs, rather than on the community as a whole. And the larger community, the larger public, is not made up of 18 to 34-year-old males with smartphones. It's according to the 2010 census, 48% of the country is now considered either poor or low income. So that's one in two people in the United States. It means they earn less than 200% of the federal poverty level. More than 49 million people live below the poverty line, one in five children. And 51 million people are near poor, meaning that they struggle with incomes that are just over the poverty line. And a lot of these people have jobs. They have houses even. Some of them have health insurance, but they're trying to just get by. They afford housing, childcare, transportation. And poverty is getting more concentrated geographically. There are more neighborhoods, suburbs, and small towns. In a democracy, all these people are supposed to count. All these communities are supposed to be represented. In journalism, in this field, a lot of our conversations these days are about how to pay for news because we're all freaked out about how are we going to pay for it, right? And so we're trying to create a sustainable business model. We're trying to think about revenue streams, how we're going to pay for journalism. But I think as we have that conversation, we need to remind ourselves why it's worth paying for in the first place, that its purpose is to inform the public. So why a penny press? The future of news is online. That's definitely true. I think everybody at South by Southwest probably agrees with that. Why would I suggest that we go back to the 19th century, literally to the horse and buggy era? The reason is because the penny press and the whole explosion of cheap, popular newspapers that started in the mid-19th century essentially created, for the first time, a mass audience for news and timely factual information. When I came up with the idea for this panel, I'd been nerding out on a lot of press histories. These are just a few of the books that I would recommend people if you're interested in this topic. If you read one thing, though, I would suggest a journal article called The Mythology of the Penny Press by John Neroni, because it nails down exactly what the mythologies are and the extent to which they're true and not true. But the real fast summary is that up until the mid-1800s, newspapers were largely organs of political parties. Politicians bankrolled them, and the papers existed to influence politics. There were six-penny blanket newspapers that were so big that you really needed to be the sort of person who had a great big table in your office where you could lay the thing out in a leisure time to sit and pore over it and absorb these political tracts. And then a lot of things started to change in the country, and they all kind of came together at the same time. There were bigger cities, better transportation channels, so mass distribution became possible. And now, as now, there was a moment in which technology suddenly made information more democratic. Paper and printing technology lowered the cost to enter the market. Artisan printers were launching their own papers. A lot of them had worked for these Whig papers and been kicked around, and then were mad as hell and they weren't going to take it anymore. And they printed newspapers that were small and portable, mobile, you might say. The stories were short, the layout was a whole lot easier on the eyes, and they were cheap. By charging one or two pennies, they helped boost circulation so much that they were able to sell advertising. And here especially is where the mythology comes in. These indie publishers, they weren't tied to any existing political party, and they were very proud of their political independence. They wrote tirades against the rich oligarchs, they identified with wage earners, they sympathized with workers. They did crusading stories about things like factory fires and political corruption. This is a photograph from 1915 from the Chicago Daily News of striking garment workers scuffling with police. The 99% was their readership. These are striking garment workers reading the newspaper coverage of their strike. These papers made a conscious appeal to the broad public, to the workers and not to the wealthy. And this coverage reached out literally from the street corners to the public to create something that had never existed before, news readers in the middle classes and the working classes. Even outside of major cities, this was true because literacy was on the rise, universal education was on the rise, people were reading. In small towns and cities and villages all over the country, even on the western frontier, there were local newspapers. And advertising is a big part of what gave the penny press newspapers their independence. But the business of media and the principles of democracy have always been somewhat strange bedfellows. And the evolution of advertising and consumerism started to steer the media it supported to attract certain readers over others. So this is a slide from Pew. Study in 2010. I know it's hard to read slides like this on a screen, but it does tend to be true that people with higher levels of education and income tend to pay more attention to the news, and that's always been true. But what struck me about this slide is that there was a particularly stark difference between low-income and high-income breakdowns of who gets their news online. You can see at the bottom part, 34% of people who make less than $30,000 a year go online for news, compared to 74% of people who make over $75,000 a year. So that difference is so much more stark online than it is in any other kind of format for TV or print. Some of this has to do with who uses the internet, because there's lower internet use among people with low income. But even among internet users, that divide is there. This is a chart from Flurry Media. It's a sample of daily active users of mobile devices. So these are people who are already using the mobile web. And you can see the breakdown of cost per million impressions that publishers earn from these audiences. Not all eyeballs are created equal. And this is not new to the web, and I could show you a chart like this about just about any medium, but what's different for online news is that we can target messages so directly to a desired demographic, and that directly or indirectly is going to determine the content that gets produced, even at nonprofit media sites, because they also need advertising. And so I worry that we're heading toward a more divided media system that's going to leave people out of public conversation. So my suggestion here is that we don't just have a digital divide, we have a content divide. The news just isn't being produced about towns and cities and neighborhoods that are low income. And our institutions of journalism, mostly newspapers, have come apart in a lot of ways, in some ways for the better. As we build up a better media system, we have to remember, our country needs a better media system. Without it, we can't function, we can't govern, and we can't ensure that we're going to solve our problems. And if we build the media system of the future around what advertisers want or think they want, which is a whole other panel, then we're not going to create a media system that serves our country's needs. We're at risk of leaving half the country behind. We need a news system that's going to reach out and pull people back into the conversation. We need content to be delivered on a platform that low-income people can and will access. It's probably going to be mobile or SMS. We need libraries and librarians to help them sort through the clutter. We need to get back to building literacy and education, and we need coverage that's mindful of the whole community, not just the high-dollar niche. So I'm going to turn this over now to our panelists. Jessamine West is a librarian. She lives in Vermont. Her site is librarian.net, and she's also a community manager at Metafilter, right?
Hey there. I'm basically the sort of, Fiona was on a panel of mine last year talking about journalism in a digital divide panel. Now I'm here talking about the digital divide in sort of a journalism panel, talking a little bit about why it's important and what roles libraries have. I wrote a book this last year called Without a Net, which is all about teaching technology to people who are still learning how to use email, Google, learning how to use a mouse. I basically get somebody their first email account pretty much every week in Randolph, Vermont, where I work. So a couple just statistics that I think people know, but I just want to go over them anyhow. These are things we know. The Pew Center for Research, the Pew Center for Internet Research, 34% of Americans have no broadband at home. And then the more sort of startling statistic to me, 21% of Americans have no internet at home whatsoever. Now, some of these people, this number has shifted a little bit since this came out in 2010, but we're still looking at 20 to 19% of Americans no internet at home at all. And there's a couple reasons for this. The IRS did a really great study of why aren't people online? We want them to do their taxes online. We save $2.50 every time somebody does their taxes online. What's the problem? And the problems fall out in four sort of predictable areas. Either you can't get it, either you can get it, but you can't afford it. You can get it, you can't afford it, and you don't want it. You can get it, you can afford it, and you're afraid of it, which is sort of where I wind up seeing a whole bunch of people who have been slightly too timid to even interact with the internet. And what's that about? That's the big question that we have to answer in the library world, trying to figure out why people aren't getting online, because more and more it's getting to the point where they have to interact with their government, to participate in a democracy, to fill out a job application, et cetera. So what I'm interested in is the way the media portrays the internet and how that affects people's decisions to use it, to get online. So the Pew Center for Excellence in Journalism does a bunch of research. Okay, what are people thinking? So you've never used the internet, and all you know about the internet is from watching television and from reading the newspaper. What do you think the internet is? And there's two main things you think the internet is. One, 23%. Hey, it makes you more productive, right? It's all parties and getting your work done faster and watching, you know, being entertained and all that stuff. Number one, 23%. Yay, internet. That's the internet that I live on a lot of times, right? It's great. It's great. But the second one is, the internet's not really safe. You know, I read in the paper that the internet just isn't safe. What happens as soon as you get online and someone steals your identity and then they steal your children. And then, you know, and then you're done, right? What else do you have? So you read these stories about identity theft. You read these stories about hackers. You read these stories about anonymous. You read these stories about viruses. You don't even know enough to know that those stories do not apply to you. You just know that it's dangerous and you don't have to go there. And as a result, people are making decisions, active conscious decisions, to stay offline, which is bizarre to me, but very, very real, and we sort of know a lot about it. So it's summed up in basically one basic sentence, which is people learn through the media and other people, their friends, maybe their librarian, that computers can do magic. And they don't understand why computers can do some sorts of magic and not other sorts of magic. It just it's not really sort of sense-making. And so talking real quick about libraries, why do libraries become the social safety net teaching people how to use computers? And one of the things we found, one of the things the IRS has found, is of the people who aren't really using the internet, and keep in mind, this is 1 in 5 Americans, which is none of you all, right? So that's kind of interesting thinking about who these people are and where we find them. Out of those people, 1 in 10 non-users say they would like to start using the internet in the future. And, of course, the corresponding 90% are like, I just don't need it, or I don't want it, or I can't afford it, or I'm afraid of it, which is why the portrayal of the media to the internet from the media to people who don't understand it, super important. And then this slide, which is another Pew slide, you can tell they use all the same colors. Fiona and I read the same stuff, is the Research Center Internet and American Life Project. Okay, you're not online and you have to get online. What do you need? 21% say, oh, I could totally get online. I'm just not into it. 4% have no idea. Like, I don't even know how I get started. 14% not interested at all. But then you've got the 60%, I'd need someone to help me. One of the things about the digital divide, like any kind of institutionalized sort of poverty situation, is not only are you not online, but you don't know anyone else who's online who can help you. So those people, if you're not coming up through an educational system, are coming to the public library where we have public space, very important, computers, very important, broadband access, which for a lot of people, especially in rural communities, they don't have, and staffing. 97% of the population of the U.S. is served by a public library. That's tough coverage to find with... What's going on there?
The red's not showing up. It says...
It looks good on her screen.
It's like one of those bumper stickers that you leave out. So the library is a public space with computers, broadband access, and staff, and I'm never going to use red again on my slides. Let's get to one that you can actually read. So there's multiple divides, which are the economic divide. You get that. You can't afford a computer. There's the usability divide. You don't know how to use it, or the websites suck. One of the things that we know about the online world is, well, one of the things we know about people in general, 40% of Americans have lower literacy skills generally. Think about how much reading you have to do in order to be able to figure out what a website does or how to use it. And so we're thinking, and think about when we talk about interactivity, then there's the empowerment divide. It's that group of people, the I don't know what I would do, I don't know how I would do it. We know that there are participation inequalities. We have that 90-10 rule, you know, in any sort of group, you've got 90% of the people not interacting, 10% doing most of the stuff, and then 1% really driving it. Well, the big deal there is, you know, once you learn that Wikipedia is run by like 1,500 dudes, it gives you a different idea of what Wikipedia is. I love Wikipedia, but let's be realistic about who it's reaching. So my big push is the difference between equality, everyone has equal options to access, and equity, meaning what can they do once they get there. If we give everybody a computer and everybody broadband, we still don't have equity in the sort of digital divide environment. And the reason it matters, stuff like this. Bank of America sends me some email and says, I need your password to do this thing. Oh, that's great, except I don't actually have a Bank of America account. For me, this is easy. For someone else, this is hard, impossible, and there goes your identity, and, you know, there goes your children. Google really wants my phone number for various reasons. Now, remember, if you've got low literacy skills and you're trying to figure out what to do here, you're not going to be clicking here to the tiny blue link in order to be able to get to the next thing. You're just going to do what Google wants you to do, which is give you your phone number. And I like Google, but realistically. And then they ask you, are you sure? And you're timid and you're worried and you're not sure this is the right thing. Discover wants me to transfer some balances for whatever reason. Where's the button you want to click if you don't want to do this? It's over here. It's not the big orange button that matches the big orange number. And the post office. You would think the post office would be on my team, right? I'm trying to send a package to Michigan from where I live in Vermont. The post office website says that it's going to cost me $24. Oh, I have to click one more link to figure out what first class postage is. These are sort of intentional. So realistically, the reason we have public libraries is so that people can function in a democracy, so that they can get the information that they want in order to solve their own problems. And as far as I'm concerned, access to information, all information, it's a right in America. It's not the privilege of a few, and especially not the few who understand how to get it. So the more we enlarge the people and the community who get it, the more we live up to our own ideals. Everyone probably saw this during Occupy Wall Street, but what a lot of people don't know is that this woman is actually a school librarian from New York. And what a lot of people may also not know is librarians are always marching for one thing or another. But this time, the thing that we're pushing for is this kind of digital equity so that we can actually share the news and the information people need to make their decisions with everybody.
Great. Thank you so much, Jessamine. I really appreciate it. So next, I'm going to introduce Tom Stites. Tom is a veteran newspaper editor and reporter, and he is now starting a project called the Banyan Project, which you can find at banyanproject.com. And Tom's going to talk a little bit about his sort of odyssey toward this new model.
Thank you. Oh, I've got a prop here. Forgot my props in my pocket. This is my slide. So I'm going to start by making you an offer. This is not a bet. It's an offer. You have absolutely nothing to lose. Are you okay with that? Okay. Yesterday, the government issued new statistics on the job creation and unemployment rate. This happens every month. We probably all know that. So here's the offer. If you ever bring me one news story from any widely available source that does not, by the time it gets to the fourth paragraph, quote an economist or other expert is saying what these new numbers mean to the markets, I will give you $20. I have made this offer to hundreds and hundreds of people in rooms like this, and I have yet to fork over even one Jackson. They're all still in my pocket. I submit that this is a problem, a serious problem, not for my wallet, but for the huge public of everyday Americans who are neither affluent nor poverty-stricken. This is roughly half the population whose net worth ranges from meager to negative. You know, a statistic I came across the other day is that 65% of all American households have a net worth of $25,000 or less, going well into the negative range. So think about it. If you're one of these folks and you are reading this story that you're bringing me or not bringing me because it doesn't meet the criteria, is the return on the return of investment on your retirement fund your most important concern? Well, no. What you're looking for is signals in those new statistics that say where you can get a better job. But we don't write about that. American journalism, as it's configured today, does not write about that or write about a whole range of other problems that are specific to the lives of the people that the penny press used to cover with care and with compassion, even. These are critical issues that can keep people up at night and make them lose sleep. And the newspapers, and I will come back to say why I say newspapers, don't cover them anymore. Now, this is just one of the ways that the newspapers have abandoned everyday people. Back in the day before about 1975, newspapers across the country aimed for 100% market penetration. They wanted to sell a newspaper to every house in their community. They never got above about 80% in the most successful places, which is about what we now have in terms of internet penetration. But now newspapers aim to reach at most 40%, the upper two quintiles of the income distribution. So this is a tectonic shift. How did this happen? It's really pretty simple. It came about in response to another tectonic shift in retailing. As discounters like Walmart grew, they drove away, or out of business, a whole array of department stores that used to be the bread and butter advertisers of newspapers. And the discounters rarely advertise. So almost all the remaining newspaper advertisers are upscale retailers that have absolutely no interest in paying to have their ads seen by people who cannot afford to shop in their stores. So to attract new advertisers, as the old ones faded away thanks to Walmart, newspapers started topic feature sections, home decor, personal finance, health, wine and gourmet food. And these drew in new categories of upscale advertisers, retailers. And the features that they stuffed these sections with presume that the readers have plenty of money to spend and that they have health insurance, for example. So one of my favorite examples of health section lead stories is the headline, "When Getting a Second Opinion, How to Get the Very Best." Now, what about the 50 million Americans who have no health insurance and who struggle to get one opinion without ending up in the poorhouse? Well, the newspapers have discarded them. They've discarded them. And in return, these folks have stopped reading the newspapers because they are no longer relevant to their lives. They're relevant to the lives of the people who have money to spend. So I'm sure you've noticed that I'm talking mostly about newspapers, and I'm deep into a digital news project myself. This may sound strange, but the fact is that newspapers have been for a long time and remain the primary source of original reporting on almost everything. So I focus there because what I think is, however cleverly we aggregate, if it ain't there, you can't aggregate it. So what really matters is original reporting. So the less than affluent the people, the penny press, used to extol, are at best today ill-served. They're abandoned to the vapidities of soundbite television journalism and to the diatribes of cable news. This is a disaster for democracy, and we have a lot of work to do. Thank you. Can I say one thing about the Banyan Project, which I'm doing, actually sets out to serve people who are less than affluent and everybody, as a matter of fact, to try to do what newspapers used to do, which is serve everybody. We're working to launch a pilot project right now in Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is an old shoe manufacturing city, and it will be, the point is to have a sustainable business model that's replicable from community to community, from coast to coast, and it is based on the sturdy foundation of consumer cooperative ownership that bunches of readers would own their community's information source the way that foodies own food co-ops and depositors own credit unions. And in case anybody's interested in knowing more, I'm about to start a big crowdfunding round, and I'll be at the back of the room later, but I wasn't supposed to plug it. Is there time for one story idea? Or do I use
No,
it?
I think we'll come back
okay.
to that during discussion.
Thanks. Okay,
Thank
great.
You. So how do we do this? So how do we reach these people? I'm going to now introduce the first of two people who are working on some really innovative projects to try to reach these audiences. And the first of them is Norberto Santana, who's a founder and editor-in-chief of voiceofoc.org, which covers Orange County, California.
How's everybody doing? Can you hear me okay? We founded Voice of OC back in 2009. Most of us were investigative reporters at major dailies. You want the next one? And the idea is that you take back America one city hall at a time.
There you go.
The idea is that a lot of the reporting that goes on these days, whether it's national health care or Afghanistan or Iraq or the Arab Spring, I keep joking to my friends that I'd love to see an American Spring where you actually see people getting involved in their own city halls instead of having things like general plans, Walmarts, traffic impacts just basically shoved down their throat. They don't show up at City Hall anymore. They don't know who their local mayors are. As Tom mentioned, it's a true crisis in America, and it reminds me of the turn of the century where you just had such a large segment of people, whether they're connected digitally or not, disconnected from City Hall, which means it's turning into one of the most corrupt places in America because the actual newspaper doesn't cover it anymore. You want the next slide? For example, in Orange County, we have our own newspaper. The newspaper I used to work for filed for bankruptcy in 2009. That was the year I decided to move on. Again, I was an investigative reporter there, and I always saw this sort of monetization issue coming. where you would have editors ask you, you know, well, how many page views are you getting now? You know, when you're a registered reporter and you walk into the building, there's a huge sign over the door that has how many clicks were today. Because obviously the entire advertising model is what's driving everything on the web now. Now, whether or not that's making any money or not, obviously layoffs and furloughs for reporters don't exactly inspire confidence. In our county, the Los Angeles Times once had dozens of reporters. You had almost a newspaper war occurring for readership. That disappeared, and towards the last few years, so has the coverage. What you see now, if you can go into the to the next slide, what you have is the best hope that communities have, I think, and obviously our supporters in Orange County agree, is to disconnect news coverage from that advertising machine, kind of go to what Tom's talking about, and I think a lot of us are tinkering with, is essentially putting news back in the hands of the public that it serves, you know, largely through membership, but also through one of the ways that this gets started up is to form strategic partnerships with people that are also interested in news to those communities. In our case, it's been labor in Orange County. It's also been trial attorneys. It's also been foundations like the California Endowment that are seeking to have impact in these communities where there's such a stark digital divide. Now, what we've done in our model, which is mainly investigative and local, is to turn it around. We really go after the power brokers. What we have is three or four investigative reporters that what we really do is just go after hard news day in, day out. We're a daily publication so that we're out there in a daily form. All of the office holders know that we're there. In about 2 years that we've been live, we've done about 1,800 articles. I think you go to the next slide. For example, here's a register, a copy of kind of a screen grab of the register from this week where you can see, you know, survey ranks the 10 best fast food chains. I mean, that's really important information for you guys to have before you leave in the morning, you know. I mean, that's certainly, again, a far cry from when, you know, from when the newspapers sort of represented it, that whole thing of, you know, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. You know, now you have, you know, thousands flock to Angel Stadium for tickets. This is the kind of news. I mean, recently we had another round of layoffs at the Register, and one of the things that the reporters were told to do was to write a plan about how they plan to expand their page views by double by the next year. So you can imagine if you're a city hall reporter, I mean, you're scrambling, trying to do things. Now, what ends up happening? You get lots of things on gay marriage. I mean, that newspaper loves gay marriage because it gets clicks. The Obama birther movement. I mean, in Orange County, the Register is probably one of the key coverage centers for that movement, even though it may be about 10 people in the country, but I think they're all in our backyard. If you go to the next slide, you see kind of our coverage for that same week. We've got a sex scandal that came out of the county hall where lots of female workers had a top Republican official basically harassing them on a daily basis. And the entire county bureaucracy covered that up because it's an old boys network. And it kind of that story in and of itself tells you about where female workers are valued within that county government. Up to the right of it, there's a conflict of interest at a local water board. In our area, there's something like 24 different water districts that get no coverage at all. There's never a report that goes to any of their meetings. And in Southern California, water is one of the huge, huge issues. So in general, the impact is very clear. It's when you write things, people, it's that thing of if you build it, they will come. You can go to the next. If you cover it, if you cover these stories, you will get the clicks. They do every time. Our coverage has gone up, or our clicks have gone up by like 80%. We're at about 50,000 unique visitors now every month. All of the different city councils are incredibly accountable to us. We're finding that they have more and more policy impact. We've already been told that we've changed the politics of places like Anaheim, which is one of the largest cities in Orange County, which, again, the Register, our competitor, not really competitor, but the main newspaper of Orange County, covers by covering Disneyland, not the City Hall. we get credit a lot already for changing the politics of Anaheim, making it much more broad-based, because, again, the accountability coverage is there. That's how I think you go after and give representation to many of those poorer communities, is really target the people who I always say push a red or a green button, and you really put the focus on them and what they're doing. And you really find that once they're being asked questions, once their story's being done about what they're doing and not doing, it changes their behavior right away. And I think that's the most effective way to get change quickly. There's just a couple of quotes on something we're getting, which one of the things that we concentrate on is being nonpartisan. We're not progressive. We're not conservative. We literally go after the investigative stories where they come, which has really gotten us a lot of support from both left and right. We probably tick them off at least 3 or 4 times a day, because, I mean, we get phone calls all the time from, you know, we get support from labor. We do write critical issues about labor. We get lots of phone calls when we do that from our labor friends. We get lots of phone calls from our conservative friends when we go after Republican office holders. In general, though, as long as we are, in a sense, barbecuing people on a regular basis and moving it around, what we found is a good loyal following that really go after the news, and it's news that really allows them to sort of get involved in public policy. I think that's it. This is the last thing I just sort of mentioned, was our partnerships. One of the things I think is important as a nonprofit newsroom is to be embedded into your community. So what we've done was, for example, the California Endowment, we have a great healthy community reporting program where we really cover the health impacts of things like general plan amendments, whether a Walmart's going to come in or not, what the kind of food choices that are even offered at airports from the county. The other thing we've done is we've circulated content through the Associated Press. We've got a partnership with the PBS and with the NPR affiliates. We also work with California Watch. And in general, we also have a very aggressive partnership with Californians Aware, which is a First Amendment advocacy group. So one of the things that we're also doing very regularly is challenging city halls, even litigating where necessary, when records and other things are not being made available to the public. What we generally find is it's just like the schoolyard where you were a kid. One fight, you don't ever have to have a fight again because they start complying. Just leave it at that.
Great. Thank you so much, Norberto. So check out voiceofoc.org. Now I want to introduce Ryan Thornburg. He's a professor of journalism at UNC Chapel Hill. And he is working on a project. He was a reporter for a long time and worked at the WashingtonPost.com. He teaches online news to journalism students, and he is working on a project called OpenRural.org, right?
Yeah.
And so check out at OpenRural on Twitter.
All right. So the one place, if you're running a news organization, the one place where you cannot ignore poor folks is when that is who your audience is. And that's a lot of where I'm looking at doing my work right now. There's a place where there's still a strong tie between the readers of a community and its newspaper, and that's throughout rural America. If you look at small newspapers, especially in rural places, there's still an incredible amount of trust, an incredible high pickup rate of newspapers. We're talking about print newspapers. The first place that I'm beginning to work is in Columbus County, North Carolina. And like most counties in North Carolina, it's rural. And like most rural counties, it's incredibly poor. But this is also a place that where the newspaper that comes out twice a week, there's a woman that stands in the middle of the street on the main street of town and hands out papers, sells papers to cars that are driving by, right? So, like, the paper gets printed and lands at 11 o'clock in the morning, and the woman is, it's amazing to see. She's, like, handing out papers over here, handing out papers over here. So why are we working on a digital project with rural newspapers? There's two basic reasons. One is so that the newspapers can defend themselves against companies that want their revenue streams without making a commitment to the community. And this is part of what's happened in mid-major newspapers all around the country. And the rural and the poor communities haven't really been a place where that's been an opportunity for outside interlopers yet. And we want to increase the capacities for analytical and accountability journalism in rural communities. So if you talk about is a rural newspaper like the News Reporter in Whiteville, North Carolina, are they serving their audience? The answer is absolutely and emphatically yes when you're talking about event and commodity news stories, right? Something happens, you go to cover a meeting, there's an opening of something, and you write about what happened. What we want to do is help all newspaper reporters not just lower the cost of writing about the who, what, when, and where, so that they have more opportunity and more capacity to cover the how and the whys of communities. So let's talk about Columbus County. What does it look like? It's about 22,000 households in the county. About 38% have incomes of less than $25,000 a year, and only 19% of that county has income above $75,000 a year. Compare that to Wake County. Wake County is where the state capital of Raleigh is. The News and Observer newspaper is there. It's almost the inverse. You've got 18% above that live on less than $25,000 a year, and about 45% that live above $75,000. So this is a poor community. In a community like that, if you run a news organization, you can't help but cover issues that they're interested in. What's interesting is that poverty doesn't translate into a lack of interest in the news. It may translate, and it does translate, into a lack of interest in, or a lack of participation in voting in that particular county. But that newspaper, the news reporter that I was talking about, it reaches just more than half of the newspapers in the county. Compare that to the News and Observer. It reaches about 20% of the households in its home county. Now, so you're thinking, everything's looking great here in this rural community. People are buying the newspaper. Who needs digital? They probably don't have internet access anyway. The problem is that the news reporter can't invest in accountability journalism in the same way that the News and Observer, a big city newspaper, can. And the problem, the reason for that is that they can't distribute the costs, right, among their readership in the way that a Wake County newspaper can. The other reason that's important to look at what's happening online is that people in Columbus County, the poor folks, the folks that are making less than $25,000 a year household income, are 25, you're more, you're, let me say this right, you're, if you threw a rock in Columbus County, you'd be 25% more likely to hit somebody that makes less than $25,000 a year is on Facebook than you would be to hit somebody that makes $75,000 a year and is on Facebook, right? There are just so many poor people in these rural counties, and they're online just enough that they represent a plurality. The number of people above $75,000 and below $25,000 on Twitter in that county is about the same, right? So it's just that it's not, it's now the pickup rate is much higher for the higher income, and as it is everywhere. But the problem is there's, or the opportunity is, I guess, is that there are so few wealthy and so many at the very low end of the income spectrum that you simply can't ignore them. And this translates into a real income challenge and a real revenue challenge for newspaper organizations. In the last 3 months, they've begun to notice that people are not picking up advertisements in the newspaper because they're posting things on Facebook, right? And this is something this is not new news to people that are accustomed to seeing their advertising revenue go off to Craigslist and their, monster.com and other places that typically made up huge advertising. So the goal is to lower the cost of getting digital information from the county government into the newspaper, increase page views, increase revenue, but then to translate that revenue into increased analytical and accountability reporting that increase trust, and that's what newspapers sell is trust. They don't sell page views. They sell trust to advertisers, and that's really what we want to do. Thanks.
Great.
Thank you so much. So definitely check out – you can follow @OpenRural on Twitter. So I want to open it up to questions now. I'm sorry we don't have a ton of time, but please feel free to ask questions of any of the panelists. Yes.
I think that's that goes back to the point I was making about they do a great job with commodity news coverage, right? And so they'll reprint the press release. They'll do anything that's a low cost, right, because they're trying to make sure that they're keeping their margins high. And the real challenge is to keep reducing the cost of getting public affairs news, not press release news into the newspaper so that they can spend and reinvest on stuff that increases trust, which is accountability journalism. So, yeah, it's a huge issue, and it's about, you know, the cost of doing business, and what we want to do is lower the cost of doing business.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we do what we're doing at Voice of OC. It's just frightening. I have many friends in PR and at the city halls that'll tell me, this is great. I send out a press release, and we're not talking about a small little ethnic press that just runs it. We're talking about major newspapers that just take your press release and they run it. And once again, it's one of these things where it's like Arab Spring. This is hilarious. I mean, in other countries that I've been to, I used to work for the National Endowment for Democracy, and we go into other countries, and these very similar things. You say, well, you need a more robust news because it's central to your democracy, and yet community after community, and we're not talking about small towns. This is in major cities where this is happening again and again and again, where city halls are able to craft their own coverage now.
Yes. Could you speak into the microphone so we make sure to get it for the podcast?
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about sustainability and how you finance the operation? How do you see, you know, the next session in here is going to be philanthropy is not the future of journalism.
Right.
So, you know, I'm very, let me give my bias. I'm very enthusiastic about nonprofit journalism becoming part of the new ecosystem. So I'm enthusiastic about that. I'm curious about this other session and, and your opinion on that.
It's a great point because you're right. The communities that you're trying to cover don't monetize, and that's the reality of that. One of the things that we've tried to do, and you can't live off of foundations forever. Foundations are good to start up and to get you going, and you can use that. You can, you know, finance off of foundations, I think, and I don't know, we're in year two. I think you can probably last on that for about maybe 5 years at most, but you've got to try to develop other types, other ways to generate income. One of the things that we're working on is a premium product where we have two through our partnership with the Associated Press, with PBS, and with NPR. We get a certain amount of public interest news that is out there. One thing that we're developing is to have more of an inside government news market so that we can take the same information that we track for an insider market. Things like campaign finance, public calendars of council members, voting records, things that are really not available anymore at your general newspaper in a kind of a consistent kind of way, and establish that to a higher end user, but that again, that also finances the broad-based operation. The other way is to do it through kind of what, like Tom is talking about, through membership models, which have really been proven to work over time and time again over years with PBS, NPR, food co-ops. I think the key there is you've got to provide a product in a daily way and show impact to the community in order to get them to, in a sense, become strategic partners as well.
Yeah, I think Tom actually has some things he wanted to add to that.
Thank you, Norberto, for the idea of bringing up the idea of the co-op. The entire discourse about the future of journalism over the last 6-7 years since it really heated up has been for-profit versus non-profit models. And what's turned out so far is that none of these models on either side of that divide has turned out to be both self-sustaining and replicable the way that newspapers were self-sustaining and replicable from community to community all over the place, or that radio news and things of that nature is a model. You just do it again in another city. No one, that hasn't happened yet. I'm not sure that this is to say that it won't, but it hasn't yet. But there are some that do self-sustain, but they tend to be one-offs. They're scattered around the country, and hooray for the people who are doing them. So what I've been working on is trying to come up with a model that is reliably self-sustaining and replicable. And the only place I've come up to find one is in the cooperative model, which is not for-profit in the usual sense of investor-owned, nor is it non-profit. It's a third sector. We talk about the three, you know, the public, private, and citizen sectors. This is squarely in the citizen sector, and I would just encourage people to explore this as a possible model. Starting a co-op isn't easy, But if it gets started, they tend to start. They arise in response to market failure. In the Depression, thousands and thousands of credit unions started because the only place to get a loan was from loan sharks. And people, poor people, pooled their money, made credit unions, lent to each other, and they thrive today and are growing today. So there are ways these things work, and I'm just hoping that I'm not the only person that's going to be exploring the co-op model.
Yeah, you should check out, Tom wrote some great stuff for Neiman Lab. Was it Neiman Lab?
Yeah, Neiman Journalism Lab in December. There are three stories that go into the sort of the news desert and then into the idea of co-op forms.
Yeah, so check it out. So we have time for definitely one more, hopefully two more questions. Okay.
Real quick, just wanted your opinions on companies like Patch.com. They're going into hyper-local news, but take the advertising back to AOL. Necessary evil, or how do we get around that, or how do you work with that?
I'll start with that. So Patch only goes into high-income areas, is my understanding.
Yes. I live in Vermont. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, Patch is cherry-picking neighborhoods that they think that they can have the greatest financial return. That's actually exactly what I'm talking about. And it's fine. I mean, if they can make it work, that's great, although it doesn't really look like it's working.
Is that a new model? Because when they first started out, they were in a lot of rural towns, but does somebody know about that? Because they started with a lot of smaller ones, and they're losing so much money with it. Maybe they've just gone to that new model.
Ryan, do you know more about that?
I don't know, where their markets broke down, but it's not... You've seen this in print. You've got every town, big or small, has the Penny Saver or something like it, right? Which is just all classified advertising, and that's very similar to what Patch and a lot of other companies are doing. And the advertising rates are small because they don't have a lot of trust and credibility, right? So it gets back. You need editorial content to increase the value of your advertising, and I don't think they have the quality of editorial content, nor would they over a period of time. I think it's interesting, and I love seeing people experiment with stuff, but I don't see them having a big impact without having high editorial quality.
One more question. I think you were at the mic there.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is there a model for successfully engaging the communities and the audiences that we're talking about as sources for stories, as commenters, as getting the two-way conversation going? And it could be that libraries are actually better at that than a lot of news organizations.
That's a great question. I don't know of one, but yeah, Jessamine, could you address that?
Well, I think part of the question about engagement has to do with outcomes. Like, I think the engagement's going on at the library. What's not necessarily happening is the activities that are bringing people together at the library aren't always, and we're not very good at this, being broadcast back out into the community, and I think that's the real thing. Capturing stories... The internet's great with that, and it's awesome, and it's great at getting the content in. And as libraries, we've historically been not only curators of cultural material, but protectors of cultural material, which has often meant don't be touching it quite so much because you mess it up with your sticky kid fingers. And so what I'm really hoping and why I'm sort of interested in journalism personally is so that we can bring that back out. There's been a lot of talk in the last couple of years about libraries using, stuff like their photocopy machines and their printers and their hold on communities and getting more technical by being maker spaces, by making capital investments in tools such as, printing and whatever. We're seeing a lot of libraries helping people, be media creation centers, podcasting and whatever. The trust thing is still the super challenge, but I think when you talk about partnerships, as you do, they're one of the best partners you can have because they're at least stable enough. I mean, not super stable, but stable enough, and as well you can invest in them for the long haul, which gets the foundation thing a little bit not on the table. So I think part of it's being able to take in and give out cultural content where we can learn and cooperate with media people, because that's not our strength.
I'll say one quick thing before I turn over to Tom to answer that. But so when people talk about engagement online, they talk about, are people in the comment thread? Are they on the social media? Well, there's also engagement, which is just having the reporter have a person's number in their cell phone and calling them, showing up. And when somebody does take it on themselves to show up at a city hall meeting and make a comment, reporting that,
going to the community meetings in the low-income neighborhoods and reporting on, that's engagement. I mean, people knowing that they are being consulted for stories, that their stories are in the paper, and then them responding by reading and then going back to the reporter, that's engagement too. Let's not undersell that. Go ahead, Tom.
The Banyan Project has done all of its planning online so that everybody can read it. It is so hard to create a sustainable business model. I think everybody needs to be trying, and I want to share everything that my board of advisors and I have come up with in our project. And part of that, in direct response to the question, has to do with creating online community space for people to work toward constructive community change around issues they all care about, and that the journalism that the Banyan site would deliver, think of it as civic nourishment, if you will, and nourish the people are invited to click and join a conversation. Now, we don't have the software yet, but we're working. The specs are done. But go read that and copy it. Deal with it. There are ways to do it. It's not just comments. It's engagement. And I think it can be done online.
Okay, one more comment from Norberto. I think we're going to wrap up.
Yeah, one thing we did in our nonprofit newsroom is we set up a community editorial board, where what we've done is we've brought in a lot of those community connectors, and we've set them up as the editorial board. And so on a daily basis, whether you're an activist group, a business promotion group, and it really runs the full gamut, you can use our platform to put your own stuff out there and to engage conversations and even to critique our coverage, which, again, we pretty consistently get critiqued from activists on both the left and the right on a pretty consistent basis.
Great. I want to thank everybody for coming today. We really appreciate your being here, and I hope you'll share with us on Twitter or whatever, or call us, what you guys are doing. And if you have thoughts and ideas, I think I'd love to share that. So thanks also to all the panelists for coming today.
Thank you.